Chapter 2. Nothing New Under the Sun. Stem cells, those mysterious microscopic monsters, are again the subject of front-page headlines these days. The reason for all this excitement is a decision by the British Parliament. Great Britain is allowing the culturing of hybrids or chimeras, consisting of human and animal genetic material. Many politicians are still fuming about this, claiming that as far as bioethics is concerned, Britain is walking an ever more dangerous path. Many scientists, though, such as John Byrne, a professor at the University of Newcastle, think the new law on embryos is completely all right. A cell cannot have a soul, he maintains. What are these geneticists actually up to? Are they playing God in their dubious laboratories? Breeding is nothing new. We've been doing it with fruit trees, for instance, since time immemorial. Certain attributes from one tree are transferred to another tree by means of grafting. In this way, genetic characteristics pass from one tree to another without any need for people to interfere in the process. This kind of cultivation of trees, flowers, or cereals is part of everyday life, and nobody raises an eyebrow over it. Where's the difference between cultivation and genetics? In genetics, nuclear material is artificially removed from one cell and implanted in the cell of another being that has previously had its nucleus removed. This was how the famous sheep Dolly was bred in 1997. She was a 100% copy of the donor animal. This process is called cloning and always involves cells from the same kind of animal. Since then, Dolly has had her own healthy young. Chimeras, or hybrids, however, are created from different species, such as human beings and cows, as is indeed the case in Britain. The nuclei are removed from one human cell and one bovine cell. Then the human nucleus is implanted in the empty bovine cell. A short electrical impulse is used to stimulate cell division, and thus the human genetic information is multiplied manifold. Madness? It happens in nature all the time, without any intervention from mankind. So-called retroviruses, such as the AIDS virus, bore into cells and then copy their own genetic information into the DNA of the host. This cell reproduces and produces more AIDS virus cells. No geneticists are involved at all. Why would scientists want to cross humans with cows? Have they lost their marbles? Surely any basic research has some kind of long-term objective. Indeed, this is the case here. Geneticists hope that, sometime in the future, they will be able to manipulate genetic information in such a way that conditions such as Alzheimer's disease or multiple sclerosis will be eliminated forever. It's sometimes called therapeutic cloning, and it is a science that is still in its infancy. But to advance their knowledge, the geneticists require cells, and up until now, they have been using egg cells from young women. This has inevitably engendered political and religious problems, because this practice material is, after all, human. The egg cells from cows, on the other hand, are available in the billions from the slaughterhouses. The combination of man and cow has nothing to do with Frankenstein, however. It is not about creating talking cows or mooing bipeds. Why not? Cells multiply into ever larger clumps. Before these can ever develop into an actual being, they need to be implanted into a uterus, and that is still strictly forbidden. But what happens if it is done in secret? British law requires that hybrid human bovine embryos are destroyed after 14 days. What's more, the probability that any of these kinds of cell clumps live any longer than that is extremely remote, but not impossible. It depends on the biotechnological technologies used at a particular laboratory. Outside of Great Britain, all sorts of even more outrageous things have been going on. Australian geneticists working on biologist Andrew Pask's team at the University of Melbourne managed to transplant the genetic material of a Tasmanian tiger into a mouse embryo and successfully managed to get the cells to multiply. The alarming thing about it is that the Tasmanian tiger has actually been extinct for many decades, and the cellular material they used had been lying around in a jar of alcohol for at least 100 years. Professor Pask wasted no time in announcing that by using his technique, it would even be possible to bring animals like dinosaurs back to life as long as they could scrape together enough DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. And it would be no problem at all to produce a Neanderthal man. Similar experiments are going in labs all over the world. In London, there is even a DNA bank storing the basic genetic material of all kinds of animals. Memories of the Future. Strangely enough, I discussed all of these things that are now the object of extensive research in my book, Chariots of the Gods, 40 years ago. Here's a quote from that book. "And whence came the first audacious idea that the cells of the body had to be preserved so that the corpse, preserved in a very secure place, could be awakened to new life after thousands of years? Did space travelers in prehistory already possess knowledge that we must gain anew? Did unknown intelligences already know the methods with which to treat bodies so that they could be revived in so many thousand years? Nowadays, the field of genetics is actually realizing the science fiction idea of Jurassic Park. What is being tried today, and will someday succeed, was already being done thousands of years ago, and there are ancient witnesses. Manetho is the name of one of them. He was a scribe in the holy temples of Egypt. The Greek historian Plutarch mentioned Manetho as one of the contemporaries of the first Ptolemaic kings, 304 to 282 BC. Manetho wrote his three-volume work in Sebennytos, a city on the Nile Delta. The second witness, Eusebius, who died in 339 AD, is another classic historian. He is recorded in church annals as the Bishop of Caesarea, and in his magnum opus, Chronographia, he quoted many ancient sources, which he deliberately and meticulously recorded. Manetho and Eusebius complement each other in their descriptions of the ancient records. Manetho begins his history by listing the names of the gods and demigods, and even quotes the years of their dominion, citing spans that would have most archaeologists in paroxysms. The gods of Egypt, he asserts, ruled for 13,900 years, and the demigods that followed them for another 11,000 years. The gods, Manetho wrote, created various beings, monsters, and chimeras of all kinds. Eusebius confirmed exactly the same thing. The following quote from ancient sources fits in incredibly well with the contemporary debate on these hybrids. "In those times, the gods created monstrous beasts with strange appearances. There were men with two wings, and some with four wings and two faces. They had one body, but two heads, of a man and a woman, and two sets of genitals, male and female. Other men had the legs and horns of a goat, or the hooves of a horse, or the rear end of a horse and the front of a man. Other beasts they made, such as bulls with human heads, dogs with four bodies and fish tails protruding from their rear end. Horses with dogs' heads, and other monsters with the head and body of a horse, but the tail of a fish, and other beasts with the form of all kinds of wild animals. As well as these beasts, there were fish and reptiles and snakes and many other strange creatures, each of which had a different appearance. Representations of them were set up in the temple of Belus." It's pretty strong stuff that Eusebius serves up from the ancient sources. Men with wings? Is this nothing but old nonsense? If so, why are there so many reliefs depicting just this on columns and sculptures in all the major museums of the world? In the world of archaeology, they even have a name for them. They call them winged geniuses. Men with the legs and horns of a goat, utter claptrap? How about taking a look at some Sumerian and Babylonian cylinder seals? They feature images of these chimeras in their hundreds. And men with the hooves of a horse and the rear end of a horse and the front of a man, did they exist too? Say hello to the centaur! And the gods created bulls with human heads, holy Apis in Egypt help us, including the Minotaur of Crete. Monsters from the past. The past steamrolls the future. Up until now, all these chimeras have been explained away in psychological terms, wishful thinking, reveries, and mythology. So what is a sphinx? Simple, it's a hybrid. Of course, if you mention the word sphinx, then everyone immediately thinks of the huge lion figure with the human head next to the Great Pyramid of Giza. But sphinges, yes, that's the plural of sphinx, come in all shapes and sizes. Lions' bodies with rams' heads, dogs' or goats' bodies with human heads, rams' bodies with birds' heads, human bodies with birds' heads, and so on and so on. There are whole avenues lined with all kinds of sphinges in among the desert sand. Anyone who has whiled away a few hours in a large museum or browsed through a book about Sumer, Assur, and Egypt will be able to sing the song of songs about these strange creatures, as Eusebius calls them. On the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III, now kept in the British Museum, two men can be seen leading strange beings with human heads and animal bodies on short leashes. Monkeys, the experts would have us believe, but they are certainly not that. Two other hybrids can be seen being led on chains. One of these chimeras seems to be sucking on its thumb, and the other almost looks a bit to be thumbing its nose at the man in front. These monsters are alive. That can be seen from the short leashes and chains. The accompanying cuneiform writing speaks of captive human animals that are to be offered up as sacrifices. In the subterranean caverns of far-off Ecuador in South America, there lies not only a metal library, but also a collection of hybrid creatures, at least according to the eyewitness report of one Petronio Jaramillo Abarca. Moving to a third chamber, imagine my surprise to discover figures half-human, half-animal, as if all the mythologies had united to display themselves in gold and precious stones. There were bodies with heads of hawks, with horses' feet, with wings, birds with human arms and legs, donkeys with faces of men, a multitude of combinations of beast and human. And some of these creatures, at least, are supposed to have really lived? Created by the gods? What on earth for? What use could these ominous gods possibly have had for these strange crossbreeds? That the gods of the mythologies, the involuntary founding fathers of the major religions, were in fact visitors from distant galaxies is something I don't want to get into here. After all, I've written 25 books on the subject. The point is this. Any space-traveling species would be sure to know a whole host of other planets apart from the Earth. There would be worlds where it is hotter or colder than it is here, and yet other planets where the gravity would be greater or, alternatively, less strong. Take the Moon, for example, where we humans can make huge jumps of several yards. On Jupiter, on the other hand, we would be squashed flat by the extreme gravity. The extraterrestrials would be sure to know all this. On the Earth, maybe they observed a scaled monster as it dozed by the Nile, seemingly unaffected by the blistering heat. We're talking, of course, about the mighty crocodile. Then they might observe the graceful might with which a lion devours a gazelle. So the aliens look at each other and wonder, what would happen if we combined the scaly armor of the crocodile with the bones and musculature of the lion to create a new life form, possibly to be used on a planet with different conditions to Earth? Thus, the creation of the chimeras began. The extraterrestrials were probably only 30 or 40 years ahead of today's geneticists, enough to decode the DNA and rearrange the building blocks of the genetic code. The gods look on their creations with pride, while mankind looks on in fear. But then comes the point when the strangers must return to their mother ship. It would, of course, be totally unnecessary and impractical for them to actually transport their artificially created monstrosities by spaceship. The extraterrestrials didn't need to take the actual chimeras with them. All they needed were a few samples of intact genetic information. That wouldn't be at all heavy, but would be enough for them to genetically engineer the creatures on a suitable planet, ideally adapted to the local environment. How can one back up a hypothesis like this? Apis and other chimeras. First, there are a number of indications that can be found again and again. Ancient historians such as Manetho, Plutarch, Strabon, Plato, Tacitus, Diodorus, Herodotus, and the later church prelate Eusebius all wrote about it. Manetho reported that the artisans and masons had depicted these creatures in paintings and sculptures. That's right. There are thousands of them. We are also more than well aware of the god cults of the ancient races. The gods climbed into their barks and winged sun disks, Egypt. Rode heavenly pearls, Tibet. Flying seashells, the Maoris. Vimanas, India. Or, as described in the Old Testament, the Lord's flaming chariot, and came down to the people of the earth. Added to this, you have the technological legacies, such as the incredibly accurately worked stones in Pumapunku. Finally, there is the fact that the gods also taught elements of their wisdom to mankind. There was a definite flow of information. The most eloquent descriptions of this can be found in the book of the antediluvian prophet, Enoch. Some random natural catastrophe, as the establishment is always trying to palm off on us, is certainly not the cause of that. They don't talk, and certainly don't dictate their knowledge to willing listeners. Extraterrestrials, worshipped and feared as gods by Stone Age peoples, were masters of the high art of genetics, and they used this knowledge on the Earth. What was their motivation? To create beings suitable for other planets. Back in Egypt, there lived a holy monster, the Apis bull. The ancient Egyptians saw Apis as the offspring of the cosmos, a creation of the god Ptah. This earliest veneration is documented in depictions featuring star-bejeweled bull heads that were found near Abydos. Greek historian Plutarch, born around 50 AD, wrote that the divine animal was not born in a natural way, but rather was created by a beam that fell from the heavens. Herodotus, too, noted that Apis was conceived via a light from heaven. Beneath the desert sands, in the so-called Serapeum, August Mariette found a stela dedicated to Apis. On it was written, "You have no father, you are born of the heavens." Not only that, Apis also bore certain characteristics that set him apart from other bulls. Herodotus again. The Apis bears distinctive marks. It is black with a white diamond on its forehead, the image of an eagle on its back. The hairs on its tail are double, and there is a scarab under its tongue. Alongside Apis, there were a number of other bulls, which, however, did not merit the same high status as Apis himself. And where are the mummies of the holy Apis? On September 5th, 1852, exuberant Frenchman August Mariette, who later founded the Egyptian Museum, found himself in a subterranean corridor in Saqqara. In the dust on the floor, he discovered footprints, which must have been left by the priests thousands of years earlier. In front of him were two mighty sarcophagi. With great effort, the 40-ton lid of the sarcophagus was removed with crowbars and pulleys. Mariette wrote, "Thus I was certain that an Apis mummy must lay before me. My first great concern was the head of the bull, but I found none. Within the sarcophagus lay a bituminous, stinking mass which crumbled at the slightest touch. In the midst of this confusion lay small bones and 15 randomly positioned figurines." Mariette discovered the same when he opened the second sarcophagus. No skull, no large bones at all. Quite the contrary, an even greater multitude of tiny bone fragments. British explorer Sir Robert Mond, who excavated the so-called Buccium, a burial chamber in the rocks under the temple ruins of Hermonthis, came to the same shattering conclusion. The sarcophagi contained either nothing or simply bitumen filled with bone fragments. In one sarcophagus, instead of the expected mummified bull, they found the mixed bones of jackals and dogs. In the catacombs of Abusir, Mond, this time accompanied by two Frenchmen, discovered further sarcophagi, which they were sure would contain mummified bulls, as these mighty granite containers actually contained bulls' heads with horns. At last! Carefully, the French specialists, Monsieur Lortet and Monsieur Galliard, cut open the millennia-old cords and gently pulled off one layer after another of linen. Their amazement was indescribable. Within, they found a mixture of the bones of all kinds of animals, and for some of them they could not even identify the species. The second sarcophagus, a little more than 8 feet long and 3 feet wide, contained a motley mix of seven different animals. Here, too, they were unable to identify the species of two of the bones. Religion versus chopped up bones. The ancient Egyptians didn't just mummify people. They mummified all kinds of animals as well. Dogs, cats, crocodiles, birds, fish, everything. They did this, and any Egyptologist will confirm this, because they believed in rebirth. In order to be reborn, the body must be preserved. Anything else would be a sacrilege, blasphemy. As Sir Robert Mond opined, the burial of a royal mummy in any but complete form would have been unthinkable in Egypt. So why the chopped-up bones? The giant sarcophagi in the Serapeum beneath Saqqara are made of Aswan granite. Aswan is nearly 600 miles away from Saqqara. Just imagine the effort that must have cost. Beneath Saqqara, miles of passages with wide compartments were hewn from the rock. Hundreds of miles away in Aswan, specialists were blasting the hardest granite known in Egypt from the rock face, using methods that remain unknown. Subsequently, these rocky heavyweights had to be transported about 600 miles along the Nile, which back then involved navigating three sets of rapids. Ships today have the advantage of using the locks. After reaching Saqqara, these stone monstrosities were smoothed and polished in an unbelievably professional manner. Each one of these sarcophagi weighs between 60 and 100 tons. Strong arms with levers and rollers jockeyed these huge containers, carved from a single block of stone, into the pre-prepared tunnels and niches. They could not be lowered down from above, as the tunnels have a solid stone roof. So why did they go to all this effort? Just to bury some chopped-up bones, and then pour greasy tar all over them and cover them up with a 40-ton lid. Their motivation must have been something other than pure faith in reincarnation, because in that case they wouldn't have destroyed the body. So what have we got left? Were the coffins plundered by grave robbers? Did monks smash up the contents of the sarcophagi? Well, the grave robber theory wouldn't explain why there are bone fragments from so many different animals in the sarcophagi. That it was God-fearing monks seems more likely. They could have smashed up the contents with heavy iron bars, but this explanation isn't very plausible either. If monks had been involved, then the traces of their destructive Christian wrath would be apparent. Bandages would be ripped up, idols would be smashed or melted down. What did Auguste Mariette write after opening the sarcophagi? Within the stinking mass lay a number of small bones, clearly already broken at the time of burial. How is it that archaeologist Sir Robert Mond discovered bones that he assumed to be those of a jackal or dog? I could hardly blame any anthropologist who didn't further examine bones that he had found under these circumstances. And how did anyone come up with the absurd idea of four-bodied dogs, Eusebius, with fish tails protruding from their rear end? Dr. Ange-Pierre Leca is a doctor and a specialist for Egyptian mummies. He wrote about one sarcophagus containing wonderfully bandaged bulls that was discovered in the catacombs of Abusir. Again, it seemed to be just one single bull, but again, we found the bones of seven animals, including one huge old bull. A third animal must have had two skulls. Excuse me? Two skulls? Let's return to our old friend Eusebius. Many other strange creatures, each of which had a different appearance, one body, but two heads. What seemed so absurd and made no sense at all to the Egyptologists, who knew that mummies were never destroyed because that would ruin any chance of reincarnation, seems to make sense from a contemporary perspective. The gods had moved on, but they had left some of their chimeras behind. If these creatures were reborn, would they not continue to spread fear and consternation among the people of the future? This problem occupied the minds of the ancient priests, until suddenly they saw a way out of the mess. As long as the beasts remained alive, they were treated with awe and respect, prayed to, and treated as divine. After their natural deaths, on the other hand, the bones of these unearthly creatures were smashed into tiny pieces and covered in tar. Sarcophagi were made of the hardest granite, so weighty and strong that no reborn monster could ever break its way out of the tomb. The mighty sarcophagi were not there to serve the process of reincarnation, rather the opposite. They were prisons for eternity. Is it possible to prove this? Just a few bones with intact DNA would be enough, and our clever geneticists would soon be able to say if they were looking at DNA that has arisen through natural evolution or whether it was a targeted artificial mutation. Nowadays, any interference in the genome can be verified. Maybe analyses such as these have already taken place and have been classified as top secret. The God shock would just be too much for mankind to cope with, because evidence of chimeras in the dim and distant past would be indisputable evidence of alien intervention. Why? Because our forefathers all those thousands of years ago didn't have a clue about genetics. Because the ancient texts and the illustrations tell us so. And because the ETs had a compelling motive for doing it, the creation of specially adapted life forms for other planets. I call it Memories of the Future. Chapter 3. Scientific? Scientific! There are no absolute truths, and if there were, they would be boring. Theodore Fontaine, 1819-1898. This sentence cannot really be applied to the exact sciences. 2 + 2 always makes 4. And in geometry, A squared plus B squared always equals C squared. It may be boring, but exact science does indeed bring us many absolute truths, alongside all the many errors that are constantly being corrected. However, our power of reason is not just impressed by the results gleaned by the exact sciences. The humanities, and these include so much that requires interpretation, violate our way of thinking no less. Religions fall into this category, as do philosophy, ethnology, and archaeology. Excuse me? Isn't archaeology a combined science that cites only verified findings? Of course, but the findings still have to be interpreted. They are still the subject of interpretation. This interpretation, on the other hand, relies on rationality, the zeitgeist, and, of course, on written historical evidence. Is that clear? Now, here's a short extract from Popol Vuh, the greatest writing from the legacy of the Quiché Maya. It was composed or written an unknown amount of time ago in the highlands of what is now Guatemala. Tepe kukumats e elom e kakplom ko paha sakteto e koowi e mukutal pak ug pa rashon. It might sound like Chinese to us, but to an expert, it makes perfect sense. The text describes how the Lord Quetzal Serpent fathered children, descended from the heavens, surrounded by light and covered in the feathers of the Quetzal bird, hence the name. The Quetzal Serpent is said to have come from the blackness of the heavens, and so on. On the rear side of the folio, you can read how the gods first had to enter a house of darkness and needed torches. Consequently, they smoked cigars. The god Smoking Mirror is depicted in numerous Maya temples. I admire the Maya specialists who can read and translate the ancient language of the K'iche Maya. Their skill is the result of the decades of hard work and the laborious efforts of the ethnologists who put together all the little pieces of the jigsaw. At the end of the day, though, these praiseworthy translations still remain subject to a great degree of interpretation in many respects. What do I mean? Interpretation is all down to the zeitgeist, the leading trend in rational thinking, and that is very flexible. A feathered snake never existed, so in Guatemala, the quetzal bird seems a logical choice. It has an impressive plumage and may have even reminded the K'iche Maya of a flying serpent. But the quetzal bird does not engender human children, nor does it smoke. The Maya god Smoking Mirror also doesn't look anything like a quetzal bird in any shape or form. A modern interpretation leaves room for a number of different possibilities, especially when contemporary viewpoints are brought together with other texts from other parts of the world. Impossible? Well, for the Maya specialists, just like the Egyptologists, text comparisons between Central America and Egypt are pretty much unthinkable. We're talking about two completely different cultures, they argue. That's right. So why is it, then, that when you start comparing the texts, you keep finding all sorts of similarities? The creation in Popol Vuh is very similar to that in the first book of Moses, Genesis. And there's more. If you read the Bible, you will discover that once the whole world was of one language, before the building of the Tower of Babel, that is. And it's no different in Popol Vuh. In the second book of Moses, Exodus, we find out how Moses held his staff out over the waters and divided them. The Maya tell the same story. Or in chapter 9, verse 17 of Genesis, "This is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." And in Popol Vuh, "That will help you when you call me. It is the sign of our agreement." And so on. Who was copying from whom? The authors of Popol Vuh couldn't have known anything about that Bible because their texts existed a long time before the Christian Spaniards arrived. So we can be pretty sure that there was no copying involved. These texts came about around the same campfire, so to speak. Nowadays, in our times of worldwide networking and almost unlimited globalization, you would have thought that comparing texts would be the order of the day. But neither side wants to hear anything of it. The Maya archaeologist is a specialist in his own area, the Egyptologist in his. Without exception, a bunch of well-educated, well-integrated, and respectable researchers. The only problem is, they don't work together. Each group remains staunchly anchored by his own island of specialist isolation. Contemporary? Pyramid texts. In distant Egypt, you will find the pyramid texts. What are they? They are engravings from the 5th and 6th dynasties, although it remains unclear how long the texts existed before they were chiseled into the granite. The pyramid texts are subdivided into utterances. These utterances are overflowing with gods who descend from the heavens to earth, and pharaohs who were granted the honor of visiting the world of the gods. Because our confused zeitgeist doesn't recognize any reality behind these stories, they are interpreted as being the wishful thinking of the priests or the journeys of the pharaohs after their deaths. Here are a few examples. Utterance 5:11. "Nut shouts for joy when I ascend to the sky. The sky thunders for me, the earth quakes for me. The hailstorm is burst apart, and I roar as does Seth." Utterance 2:67. "A stairway to the sky is set up for me, that I may ascend on it to the sky, and I ascend on the smoke of the great sensing. I fly up as a bird and alight as a beetle on the empty throne which is in thy bark, O Ray, that I may sit in your place and row over the heaven in your bark, O Ray, that I may push off from the land in thy boat. Utterance 302. The sky is clear. Sothis lives. The two Aeneids have cleansed themselves for me in Ursa Major, constellation. My house in the sky will not perish. My throne on earth will not be destroyed. Utterance 482c. May I fly up to heaven like the great star in the middle of the east. Utterance 434. You have taken to yourself every god who possesses his bark, that you may install them in the starry sky. Utterance 472. The sky quivers, the earth shakes before me, for I am a magician. I have come that I may glorify Orion. Utterance 480. How lovely to behold when this god ascends into the sky, just as Atum, the father of the king, ascends to the sky. Utterance 482. You must ascend to the heaven. Your son Horus will accompany you to the starry sky. Heaven is yours. The earth is yours. Utterance 553 and 563. The gates of heaven are open for you. The gates of the firmament are open for you. Utterance 584. The doors which are in the firmament are opened for me. Lie open for me. Utterance 669. The prince descends in a great storm from within the horizon. It goes on for pages like this. Heavenly portals are opened, gods descend in smoke and flames, pharaohs are allowed to fly with them. There are thunder and lightning all over the place. Sand is thrown up into the air. Who is always behind it all? The gods. Whether it's in old India, in Tibet, in Japan, in the Bible, Ezekiel, or the Maya. Now, look here, preach the Egyptologists. These texts are not to be compared with any kind of reality. They are about the ascensions of deceased pharaohs. Well, somehow, I doubt that. Looking at it from a modern perspective allows some quite reasonable and totally different conclusions, and there's nothing anti-scientific about them. Why don't the universities at least teach their students about the interconnections that are actually there? They could point out that a word like heaven does not necessarily have anything to do with a place of bliss and beatitude, and just as little to do with life after death. Heaven is also space, especially when it's mentioned in the same breath as attributes such as smoke, fire, quaking, noise, stars, and so on. What's unscientific about that? As long as the texts from each individual culture continue to be treated in isolation, then new insights will continue to be impossible. In 1975, respected philosopher of science, Paul Feyerabend, who taught for 3 decades in the University of California, Berkeley, announced his anything goes approach. It's another way of saying that anything is possible. The scientific world reacted with horror because anything goes, or anything is allowed, was a contradiction to the long-held belief in a continual scientific process of establishing the truth. Feyerabend postulated, however, that the results of any scientific method are limited by the methods themselves. Indeed, many scientific innovations thrive not because methodological rules have been followed, but because they have been broken. Feyerabend was right, and his anything goes does not contradict scientific progress at all. So a comparison between the mythologies of ancient Egypt and Central America may go against the academic grain, but it does bring new answers and therefore the desired insights. Breaking the rules means eating from someone else's bowl, but only when there's a good reason for it. And there's plenty of them. Divine intervention. Spanning the gap between Egypt and Central America makes a whole lot of sense. In both places, flaming gods rise into the heavens, even though, from the point of view of the archaeologists, the two cultures existed at different times. But who can say with absolute certainty where the origins of these cultures lay, and whether there really were any transatlantic connections all those thousands of years ago? In the Museum of Leiden in Holland, you can see a jade tablet known in the scientific literature as the Leiden Plate. It was found in the Maya city of Tikal, now Guatemala. Following the tricky-to-translate name of a god, it reads, "The lords of the heavenly family of Tikal descended." Regardless of whoever these heavenly rulers may have been, it was really no different in ancient Egypt, or in China, Japan, Tibet, or India, come to mention it. Visitors to the land on the Nile will be confronted by the so-called winged sun disk in practically every temple. It's a golden disk or bowl shape with colored, broadly spreading wings. Entire temple roofs, dendera, and countless temple entrances, karnak, are decorated with them. These winged sun disks are usually associated with the god Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, whose seat was in the huge temple complex of Edfu, between Aswan and Luxor. This is where the story of the winged sun disk is immortalized on one of Edfu's temple walls. The inscriptions describe how the god Ra and his retinue landed in the west of this area, to the east of the Pechenu Canal. His earthly representative, the pharaoh, was clearly in some sort of trouble, as he asked the heavenly flyer to help him deal with his enemies. "The holy majesty Ra Harmachis spoke to your holy person, Horhut. O you sun child, you exalted one, who is created by me, strike down the enemy that is before you without delay." Then Horhut flew up to the sun in a great sun disk with wings upon it. When he viewed the enemies from the high heavens, he stormed down so violently upon them that they neither saw with their eyes nor heard with their ears. Within a short time, not a head of them still stood living. Horhut, shining and many-colored, returned in his form as a great winged sun disk to the ship of Ra Harmachis. This text was translated in 1870. In other words, at a time when no Egyptologist would have known about supersonic flight. They didn't even have aircraft back then. But the attack described here definitely came from above, when he viewed the enemies from the high heavens, and it must have taken place at supersonic speeds that they neither saw with their eyes nor heard with their ears. The results down here on Earth were correspondingly gruesome. Within a short time, not a head of them still stood living. The gods alone know what dreadful weapon they used against this Stone Age folk. Whether Egypt, Central America, or anywhere else, all of these ancient texts are fed to us these days in a kind of psychological mush. This is a shame because interpretations are possible in every color of the rainbow. I find it hard just to imagine the saga of the winged sun disk in an abstract way, flying blind as I am in the fog of religious psychological dogma. After the god Ra Harmachis had helped the pharaoh defeat his enemies, he succinctly notes, "Here it is a pleasant place to live." Afterward, the surrounding lands are given a special name, and the gods of heaven and earth are praised. I suggest that maybe we shouldn't spend so much time reading about how other people think things are meant and the way we should, in their exalted opinions, see things, and instead look at the uncommented original texts. Horhut flew up towards the sun as a great winged disk. Thus he has been known since as the Lord of Heaven. Lord of Heaven? What about something else? What about Spaceman? As the inscriptions from Edfu show, the divine assistance was the actual reason for the worship and popularization of the winged sun disk, and not, as some would have us believe, the sun in some imaginary under- and overworld. The Edfu text says it clearly enough. Harmachis flew in a ship, and he landed by the city of Horus's throne. Thus spake Thoth, the sender of light, who is born of Ra, he has defeated the enemy. He is to be known from this day on as the sender of light, who is born of the mountain of light. Thus spake Harmachis to Thoth, bring this sun disk to all the cities of the gods in Lower Egypt, and all the cities of the gods in Upper Egypt, and all the cities of the gods. Here and there. The phrase sender of light, which I have used here, is not one of my own creations. It comes from the text of Professor Heinrich Brüsch, who translated the Edfu text in 1870. So what have the sensible and rational Egyptologists, all of them loyal and obedient to their school of thinking and the zeitgeist, made of the winged sun disk? Ceremonial oddments. The original meaning is gone. It was no fantasy or dream of the uneducated Egyptians. It was simply what we would today describe as a UFO. Incapable of recognizing the original reality, academic doctrine transforms the former truth into myth. And now the world is all right again. Really? A friend of mine, who is an Egyptologist, once told me that the thought that some god had actually intervened in a human conflict was simply unbearable. Just as unbearable as my belief that extraterrestrials had at some time taken a hand in earthly affairs. Human logic, however, is sometimes prepared to make quite unexpected leaps. In the Old Testament, for instance, God, descending in a swath of smoke, fires, and cataclysmic roars, often takes a hand to assist his chosen people in their struggles. Yes, in actual fact. Here the logic is watertight. Really? What does the winged sun disk in Egypt have to do with Central America? In 1860, not far from the village of Santa Lucia, Catamarguapa in Guatemala, on the Pacific coast, a number of magnificent stelae were found during clearance work. The news reached an Austrian researcher, Dr. Habel, who traveled to Mexico in 1862 to visit the excavation site. Dr. Habel made some sketches and showed them to the director of the Royal Museum of Ethnology in Berlin, Dr. Adolf Bastian. 4 years later, he himself traveled to Guatemala and bought all the old stone fragments from the owner of the finca where the stelae were found. Transporting these incredibly heavy stelae to Europe was a logistic headache. In the end, they decided to cut the stone monsters in half and transported them to the harbor of San Jose, 50 miles away. To make the blocks lighter, they hollowed out the rear sides. During the loading, one of the stelae broke free and sank into the harbor waters, where it still lies today. The remaining artworks from this forgotten age can be admired in the Ethnology Museum in the west of Berlin. Because archaeologists always have to label and categorize everything, otherwise they can't exhibit the artifacts, the stelae were given a rather apt name, Ode to the Sun God. And indeed, you can clearly see a flying creature, swathed in flames, descending to the frightened folk below. You really can't miss the sun disk. Extraterrestrial technology. In the Edfu text about the winged sun disk, the term sender of light crops up. Of course, that's nothing any rational Egyptologist can work with. What actually is a sender of light? Has the term been wrongly interpreted? There are, in all probability, dozens, if not hundreds, of depictions of these senders of light, but we do not recognize them because, as the biblical prophet Ezekiel said, we have eyes to see, but do not see. In the temple of Seti I, also known as Sethos, in Abydos, the goddess Isis handed the pharaoh a strange object. This object must have been something really exceptional. Otherwise, it would hardly have been attributed directly to the goddess. What's more, this object is, in terms of dimensions, bigger than the pharaoh himself. Egyptologists call this object a Djed pillar. These Djed pillars have been found in various sizes throughout the whole of Egypt, and no one, thus far, has been able to come up with a plausible explanation. Depictions of the Jed Pillar were even found under the very oldest of the pyramids, that of Djoser in Saqqara. The pillar must have been something quite special because even in the earliest ages of the old empire, there was a priesthood of the venerable Jed. In Memphis, there was even a special ritual for the erection of the Jed, which was carried out by the pharaoh with the assistance of his priests. Much later, after the original gods had disappeared and the pharaohs had been named the sons of gods, no one remembered what the Jed pillars actually were. The important thing was that it had something to do with the gods. That was all that mattered. Consequently, depictions of the Jed pillar can be found in countless variations, on temple walls, in crypts, on treasure chests, and even on vases. Jed pillars are just as common in Egypt as winged suns. The only problem is that not a single expert has come up with a plausible explanation for the original meaning of this mysterious object. I have read in the literature that the Jed pillar was a symbol of permanence, a symbol for eternity, a prehistoric fetish, a defoliated tree, a notched post, a fertility symbol, a spike, and so on. What about something else? What about a sender of light? At least that's what it looks like. Crazy? When I look at all those hokey interpretations of this curious object, I could almost laugh. What actually has to happen before we open our eyes and see things for what they really are? Looking at the Jed pillar as a representation of a technological device seems more plausible to me than claiming it is some kind of prehistoric fetish or a fertility symbol. After all, the Jed pillar was not the only object that the gods gave to mankind. Another one is the Ark of the Covenant mentioned in the Old Testament. You can read all about it in the Bible. Moses received extremely precise instructions on how to construct a technical object from his God, Leviticus chapter 25 and following. There was an original of this object. Moses was merely expected to make a copy. And see that thou make them after their pattern, which hath been showed thee in the mount. Exodus chapter 25, verse 40. Afterward, Aaron, Moses' brother, was told to form a priesthood to look after this device. So there was a team of specialists, just like the priesthood of the Jed pillar. A sender of light belonging to the gods was not something that could be entrusted to just anyone. It was dangerous, just like the Ark of the Covenant. Shortly after the construction of the Ark was completed, God warned his servant Moses that he must ensure that Aaron follow explicit instructions, or he will die. Leviticus chapter 16, verse 2. Later, the Ark of the Covenant was involved in a number of catastrophes. The Philistines captured the Ark, 1 Book of Samuel, chapter 4 and following, and all the gawkers who got anywhere near the uncanny object died of diseases that today would probably be described as radiation sickness. The nails on their hands and feet fell off, as did their hair. Their skin was covered in boils, and the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. 1 Book of Samuel, chapter 5. Verse 12. The Bible even tells us about a fatal accident suffered by a priest who forgot to follow the strict safety guidelines. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error, and he died there by the Ark of God. Second Book of Samuel, chapter 6. Verse 6 and following. Poor old Uzzah! And he was one of the priests. So what did he do that was so wrong? And what kind of God smites one of his subjects for a moment of carelessness? The Bible provides an answer. And the whole of Mount Sinai was clad in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke climbed up like the smoke from a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. Exodus chapter 19, verse 18. This same God demanded sacrifice from the Israelites, gold, silver, precious stones, and iterated to his servant Moses that he should make it tell the Israelites in no uncertain terms, "You have seen that I have talked with you from heaven." Exodus chapter 20, verse 22. You can find out more about what happened to the Ark of the Covenant and where the remains of this technical device can be found today in one of my earlier books, Signs of the Gods. Parts of the Old Testament, Bible, the Vedas, India, the Pyramid Texts, Egypt, the Apocrypha, such as the Book of Enoch, and Popol Vuh make more sense when viewed from a contemporary standpoint, and they complement each other in many areas. But when it comes to the Mayan Popol Vuh, it becomes incredibly complicated. There are good reasons for this. The book was translated into German, my native language, by a certain Dr. Wolfgang Korden, who was fluent in a number of Mayan dialects. He called the text the Book of the Council. That was 50 years ago. Korden's translation was in a flowing style of speech, easily readable by anyone who chose to. The following generation of Maya experts did not accept Korden's work and drew up a new translation, this time word for word. To understand this version, you need to have lived with the K'iche Maya for some time, because there is simply endless room for interpretation. What did they really mean? How can we understand this text? Well, for a start, we have to bear in mind that there is no such thing as an original text of Popol Vuh. All of the translations are based on a single version that admittedly existed in the K'iche language, but wasn't actually written down until the 18th century by a Christian cleric, Father Francisco Jimenez. To represent the K'iche sounds in a way that his contemporaries could read them, the priest used the Latin alphabet. He had to render K'iche words, which may be pronounced in a drawn-out, sing-song manner, phonetically using Latin letters. Easier said than done. Here are a few extracts from the literal translation. "Sovereign and Quetzal serpent, they who have borne children, luminous they are in the water. The face of the earth was not far for him, nor was Shebalba, hell, the underworld, far for him. In an instant, he could return to the sky with Wurukan. Then they arose as the central lights. They arose straight into the sky. Thus was the womb of the sky illuminated over the face of the earth, for they came to dwell in the sky. The 400 boys who had died at the hands of Sipakna also rose up to become their companions. They became a constellation of the sky. The miraculous power and the spirit essence, sovereign and Quetzal serpent. Thus their countenances appeared like people. People they came to be. They were able to speak and converse. They were able to look and listen. Straight away their vision came to them." And so on. It's pretty hard to translate this mush into comprehensible English. If I were to try, I would end up with a version that had little to do with the original. But I can say this much. Just like in the Bible, Popol Vuh tells of a confusion of languages. The people could no longer understand each other because of a stone that changed their speech when they came from Tulan. We read about valuable metals that are to be given to certain gods, but also men. There are descriptions of black people and white people, of boys that were sacrificed, of a mountain called Hakavitz, where the people multiplied, and so on and so on. It's a thoroughly mixed bag that arose from the impotence of language. The vocabulary of the early chroniclers was limited. Many of the terms they used derived from their daily lives and regular natural events, tribe and family, animals and plants, early devices and simple weapons all had names. There were words for sun, water, day and night, sunrise and sunset, lightning, thunder, birth, illness, and death. But any time something happened that could not be directly described with this sparse collection of words, then it was time to paraphrase and describe so that the available words could be made to evoke the event in the mind's eye. However, language, words arranged one after another, cannot always express the meaning that is intended. gestures are just as much a part of our communication process as pictures are or music is. At an auction, when someone raises a hand with five fingers, he is signaling to his partner in the first row that he wants to raise his bid by $50,000. Not a sound needs to be uttered. We cannot know which gestures the old storytellers of the Quiché Maya used to tell their tales. A laugh, a whine, a grimace, and a stamped foot may all have been used to change the sense of the actual series of words used. I remember once meeting a Sen, a mountain herder, in an alpine hut. He told me a tale of dwarves that, so he claimed, still lived right there in the region. When the words failed him, he gesticulated meaningfully. I could understand him without words. This non-linguistic component of communication, gestures, intonation, music, sadness, anger, happiness, or facial expressions, cannot be expressed by the simple spoken word. Spoken language is the poor relation of thought. It lumbers along after the event and has to invent new terms, words, for things that have already happened. Language is not a dogma of eternal values. It is a constantly evolving organism. Depending on the state of development of the user, language is never completely free of values. It is constantly adapting to the zeitgeist. Now, myths belong to the barely researched epochs of our past history. So, bearing that in mind, how many times may these first used words have changed their meanings since then? Not only that, all those who recorded the myths in the first place filled their words with other semantic meaning. Back in the early days of language, let's not forget, there simply were no words for the impossible. Of course, a Stone Age man would have no words to describe a helicopter, headlamps, pistols, an aircraft, or a space shuttle, a protective spacesuit, or an ear-splitting UFO, but he knew words like fire, lightning, earth-shaking, noise, and heat. And then he was forced to use these to describe the impossible event he was experiencing. This is how, in Central America, the myth of the feathered serpent arose, something that was well known in Egypt too, by the way. For instance, in the grave of Seti I in the Valley of the Kings, you can see many depictions of snakes with wings. Thousands of years later, in our age of reason, the serious and rational world of science does not want to accept that Stone Age man could realistically have had any meetings with a high-tech civilization, and that he could have seen any helicopter-like flying machine or met with beings that they, in their ignorance, named gods. When even the original texts are utterly confusing because of the incomprehensible terms and missing gestures, then the translations are bound to end up as some kind of religious psychological mishmash. The methodologies simply do not allow any other possibilities. Total chaos. Etana over the Earth. Then there is the well-known myth of Etana, once part of the clay tablet library of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, 685 to circa 627 BC. Found during excavations in Nineveh, the tablets are now kept in the British Museum in London. The origin of the story is unknown, although parts of it are present in the older Gilgamesh epic. The story tells how Etana is carried high up into the sky by an eagle. The magnificent bird repeatedly asks him to look down. After flying on high for some time, the eagle addresses Etana. "Look, my friend, how the earth appears. Look at the sea at the side of the world mountain." And the earth appeared as a mountain, the sea as a pool. After flying on even higher, the eagle addresses Etana. "Look, my friend, how the earth appears." And the earth appeared as a plantation of trees. "My friend, look down and see how the earth appears." And the earth appeared as a garden, and the wide sea no bigger than a bucket. And he carried him yet higher still, and said, "My friend, Look down and see how the earth disappears. I looked down and saw how the earth had disappeared, and my eyes could not even pick out the wide sea. My friend, I cannot go any further towards heaven. Stop now that I might return to the earth. The eagle has landed, was the message sent back to Houston by the crew of Apollo 11, as they became the first men to set foot on the moon. The eagle has landed. Even if the word heaven is used in the Etana epos, it is clear that what is being referred to here is space travel. After all, the eagle carries his burden up into the stratosphere, the wide sea was no bigger than a bucket, and up over the earth. I looked down and saw how the earth had disappeared. And now we bundle it all up in our convoluted religious psychological contemporary thinking, because things that don't fit in simply cannot be. So, you can see that we're not going to get any further by simply applying the old methods and old thinking. It seems to me that the real opponents of insight can be found within the ranks of science. Stone Age man created his godly images all over the world. The faithful followers of the established religions call these images idols if they don't fit in with their own religious preconceptions. These pictures, grotesque faces, unimaginable beings with tongues of fire, beasts and monsters, have been created by every culture from the depths of their own imaginations. Different and yet all the same, much like the language. But where is the origin of these artistically portrayed gods? Many centuries ago, Amir ibn Luhay, a traveler throughout Arabia, told of men who produced or worshipped graven images. He asked them what was the source of this worship. This was the answer he received. The pictures are the Lord's which we have prepared in accordance with their heavenly forms and persons. The father of history writing, the Greek Herodotus, circa 490 to 425 BC, himself said much the same. In the second book of his Histories, he told about his visit to Thebes, chapters 141 and 142, and how the priests explained 341 statues to him. They demonstrated then that all the people portrayed by these statues were mortal beings, bearing no relation to gods. They claimed, however, that before these men, gods had been kings of Egypt, that they had lived alongside human beings. The Egyptians claim to have precise knowledge of all this because they have always kept count of and continuously chronicled the passing years. Originally, the earth was home to cavemen, then gods, and then crossbreeds, in other words, the sons and daughters of gods. Then came mankind as we know it today, and finally the gods disappeared, but not before promising to return one day in the far future. Men fashioned pictures, statues, or, depending on the level of their development, cave paintings of these gods. But they all had the same thought in the back of their minds, the Maya, the Egyptians, the Indians, and all the others. What they depicted were the inexplicable, grandiose-seeming, and transfigured beings from another world. But they were once real. They really were active among the Stone Age peoples. The same applies to the temples. Originally, these heavenly forms served as the inspiration for the temples. Mankind has always imitated that which it admired, but also that which it didn't understand. These shrines were attractively built because the primitives hoped that the real gods would approve and come down and protect the human community from its enemies. That, of course, was often the spark that prompted the building of settlements in the surrounding areas. The priesthood did its work to ensure that faith in the gods, as well as fear of divine retribution, did not wane. The rest is history. This claim is easy enough to prove, and anyone can understand it, as long as the links to other cultures are made. Without these links, without the comparative mythology, we will probably continue to flounder around in the dark. In the 25 nonfiction books I've written so far, I have provided hundreds of attestable items of evidence. Here are some examples. Wall paintings in the Sahara, Tassili, Brazil, Sete Cidades at Piripiri, the United States, Hopi Lands, Australia, Arnhem Land at Norlangi and the Kimberley Ranges, Canada, Vancouver Island, and many more show a particularly international consistency when it comes to representing the gods. Dogu figures from Japan look very much the same as statues of gods from Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. The straw suits worn by the Brazilian Kayapo tribesmen reflect their tribal memory of their heavenly teachers, as do the Kachina dolls of the Hopi people in Arizona. All this and much more, and none of this has any weight? We can't view this as proof? If you examine the theories propounded by Erich von Däniken with an open and impartial mind, then you'll see that nothing in these hypotheses really contradicts the strictest rules of science or our understanding of the universe. Professor Louis Navia, Professor of Philosophy at the New York Institute of Technology. Those extraterrestrials, the misunderstood gods of ancient times, promised that they would return to Earth. This promised return was immortalized in the Maya mythology and in the Maya calendar. But the Mayans weren't the only ones waiting for a second coming. There is a judgment day coming.